Alerts from Chase Manhattan, or if they're still called Chase Manhattan, I don't know. Maybe they're just Chase Bank. I'm going to The Intercept for a lot of stuff. They're a little controversial lately. They hired Mariam Saleh and a cute observer, Lebanese woman I like a lot, has been going after her. But I think they're still doing great work. They have some poetry in this episode from a woman who has a book out from Haymarket out of Chicago called My Mother Was a Freedom Fighter. I'm forgetting her name right now. I was trying to pull up some of the names of the folks, but we'll just start out with Bruce Dixon here. And we've got little time for this moldering on here, but I did pull up the two things about Colin Kaepernick. Apparently, Trump said, get that son of a blank off the field. Well, he is off the field. But I also found a Business Insider article that says that his jerseys are better selling than anybody else's. So, and they're blaming Kaepernick effect for NFL less popularity. It's pretty much a trifecta between that and the absurdity of big business and, of course, brain damage. I don't know why that didn't come to mind sooner. Here's Bruce Dixon. We'll get to Amy Goodman and then two sections from this episode of The Intercept. I had a lot of other things to play with and edit. I spent a lot of time editing Jeremy Scahill's foul mouth. I did not edit Senator Carl Levin using the word blanky, which was in the correspondence of Goldman Sachs. A lot about Goldman Sachs while we're sort of perhaps celebrating the demise of Obamacare and maybe opening for single payer. I don't know, but it was really about taxes, and the tax issue is going to be high at forefront. It's actually a Nation reporter, who's Gary Rivlin, I believe, is going to be the first segment. And then about the militarization of police and the continuing training of U.S. police forces by Israeli counter-terror groups. That's a lot in an hour, and we're going to do it. Here's Bruce Dixon, the Black Agenda Report, Voices from the Back Left. Hope this comes over well.
To, if not punished. Pretty sure Ken Burns is not at all about that. At best, Burns seems to be about a species of healing and reconciliation that limits itself to Americans forgiving their trespasses against each other and excusing their trespasses against others, while dutifully acknowledging the valor of fighters on both sides. The series is not yet concluded, so we will have to wait and see whether Ken Burns ignores or buys into the discredited lie propagated by our country's war propaganda industry that unaccounted for American prisoners were somehow left behind and missing at the end of the Vietnam War. They weren't. But the little black flag and ceremonies for the imagined missing in Vietnam are standard now, 4 decades after the war's end. I didn't go to Vietnam. Vietnam came to me, or tried to. I was lucky enough to live in a big city, Chicago, and to connect with the anti-war movement, which included black soldiers and Marines returning from Vietnam. Some of them frankly confessed to taking part in all sorts of atrocities and war crimes. We took them from black high school to high school in the fall and early winter of 1967 to repeat those confessions and to tell other young black people like us that it was an unjust war, which we had a duty to resist. I thought I was risking prison, like Muhammad Ali, when I sold Black Panther newspapers at the Armed Forces Induction Center on Van Buren Street and refused to be drafted. But by then, so many young people were resisting the war that Uncle Sam's draftee army became almost useless. In that era, there were not enough cells to lock us all up, and many white Americans were declaring themselves ready for revolution or something very much like it. U.S. policymakers learned that part of their lesson well. they ended the draft, and most anti-war white protesters went home. Noam Chomsky has it exactly right when he declares that Vietnam was not a mistake or a tragic error. It was an example that said to the world, this is what you get when you defy the wishes of the U.S. ruling elite. You get bombs, you get rivers of blood, and you get your country's economic potential set back half a century. Seen that way, Vietnam was not some tragedy the U.S. blundered into by mistake. It was an example and a crime. For that reason, it's going to be a chore and a bore at best to sit through Ken Burns' Vietnam documentary. Maybe I'll just watch Game of Thrones again instead. Eh? For Black Agenda Report, I'm Bruce Dixon. Find us on the web at www.blackagendareport.com.
Okay, that was pretty terse. Traffic patterns different in downtown Champaign. I don't know if anybody's coming down to Pygmalion. I finally got it figured out, I think, why that crown is the symbol, and I've got an alternate interpretation. I wasn't going to do this because I don't have a lot of time, but the whole idea of making a, what's the other metaphor, silk purse out of a sow's ear, making this Cockney woman speak right, seems to be, and like the upstanding elite in Europe who pillage the world so vigorously. I don't know. Just a page two thing there, I guess. Dixon is a transplant to Atlanta, and he's in the Green Party Atlanta. That's a hook to mention that Rich Whitney of the Green Party, speaking about U.S. support for dictatorships around the world, another woman, a woman from the Illinois Green Party on interventions in Libya and Syria. This is at a teach-in, anti-war teach-in, also some local people. Francis Boyle, Martin Russell, David Green, CGE, David Johnson, formerly of the World Labor Hour on WEFT and now on WRFU. That's starting at 1 o'clock. Stuart Levy is documenting it, and I'm hoping I may make part of it. 1 o'clock, and they've got the room till 5, so anti-war teach-in today. I'm going to move right along and play Amy's piece, if I can get my device to cooperate. And then segments from The Intercepted. I'm pulling up the names as we speak here. Gary Rivlin is the first speaker talking about the absolutely Hippocratic. That's why Trump throws the red meat of Colin Kaepernick and all this stuff to not talk about Gary Cohn. Is that his name? That's what I couldn't remember exactly. Anyway, here's Amy Goodman with her Breaking the Sound Barrier commentary. Moving right along.
Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The torchlit procession and violent rally of neo-Nazi and Ku Klux Klan members in Charlottesville, Virginia last month, and President Donald Trump's repeated defense of the racist gathering mark a turning point in modern America. Trump doubled down last week when he blamed both sides again, denouncing some anti-racist and anti-fascist protesters as bad dudes, a day after meeting with the Senate's lone black Republican, Senator Tim Scott, whom the White House called Tom Scott. To recap, Heather Heyer, a 32-year-old activist, was killed and at least 19 more were injured when a neo-Nazi rammed his car into a crowd of counter-protesters on August 12th. Hate groups and white supremacists on the rise since Barack Obama became the first African-American president are emboldened by Trump. The history of resistance to fascism is worth recalling at this critical moment in U.S. politics and also at this time of the Jewish High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The stories of Anne Frank and Sophie Scholl, two young German women, one a Jew, another a Christian, should guide and inspire us in this darkening time. In 1942, Sophie Scholl, a 21-year-old college student in Munich, Germany, and her older brother Hans, a medical student, formed the White Rose Collective with a small circle of friends. They decided to produce a series of pamphlets exposing Nazi atrocities and urging resistance to Hitler. The first pamphlet appeared in June 1942, mailed anonymously to Munich citizens who the White Rose members thought would be sympathetic. Leaflets were dropped at bus stops and doorways, anywhere they could be delivered clandestinely. To be caught would mean imprisonment and possibly death. The second pamphlet read, "Since Poland was conquered, 300,000 Jews have been murdered in that country in the most bestial manner imaginable. Jews are human beings, too." The pamphleters encouraged passive resistance and sabotage, writing in their fourth communique, "Every person is in a position to contribute something to the overthrow of this system," unquote. The Gestapo, that's the Nazi secret police, mounted a massive search for the leafleteers. Finally, in February of 1943, Hans and Sophie were caught while distributing leaflets at Munich University. They, their professor, and other student activists were interrogated, tried, convicted, and beheaded. Meanwhile, 13-year-old Anne Frank and her family were suffering increasing anti-Jewish persecution in Nazi-occupied Amsterdam. They'd already fled anti-Semitism in their native Germany. The U.S. repeatedly denied visas for the Frank family to seek refuge in the United States. In desperation, in 1942, they moved into a hidden section of the building where Anne's father Otto's office was located, what Anne called the secret annex in her famous diary. They remained in hiding there for 2 years. It's hard to believe that Anne Frank wrote her remarkable diary between the ages of 13 and 15. She wrote, "I hear the approaching thunder that one day will destroy us too. I feel the suffering of millions." She wrote this July 15, 1944, and went on, "And yet, when I look up at the sky, I somehow feel that everything will change for the better, that this cruelty too shall end, that peace and tranquility will return once more. In the meantime, I must hold on to my ideals," she wrote. 3 weeks later, the secret annex was raided by the Nazi SS. Anne, her family, and the four others hiding there were arrested and deported to German concentration camps. Anne and her sister Margot were separated from their parents. They died in the Bergen-Belsen camp in 1945, just weeks before the camp was liberated. Only Otto Frank survived the concentration camps, going on to recover Anne's diary and share it with the world. Now, more than 70 years later, armed neo-Nazis and Ku Klux Klan groups march with torches in the United States, chanting "Blood and Soil," a Nazi slogan from the 1930s, and "Jews will not replace us." Donald Trump, whose father was arrested at a Klan march in 1927, and who himself was sued by the federal government for discriminating against African-American renters, claims there were very fine people among the white supremacist mob in Charlottesville. Soon afterward, Trump pardoned Joe Arpaio, the convicted former sheriff of Maricopa County, Arizona, who notoriously and criminally persecuted innocent Latinos and proudly referred to one of his jails as his concentration camp. Also, refugees from six majority Muslim nations have been banned, and protections and support for the LGBTQ community, also victimized by Nazi Germany, are being stripped away. "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention." That was the quote featured on Heather Heyer's Facebook page when she died. Like Anne Frank and Sophie Scholl before her, Heather was killed resisting fascism. Let all their stories inspire a new wave of bold resistance. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, moving right along to... Two segments from the latest Intercepted, lighting the pretty moving poetry that's included. Journalist Gary Rivlin co-published in The Nation and in The Intercept, and then The Intercept's Alice Sperry talking about police militarization and how Israel is training American cops. I'm going to edit a little bit of Gary Rivlin's concluding statements about how idiotic a huge tax cut would be right now, and just get to the Goldman Sachs ironies. So I can hear all of the end of the interview with Alice Sperry, and including the end, which includes some that actuality from the streets in St. Louis with the cops chanting, "Whose streets are streets?" The chant is led by a woman cop. I hear her voice now. It's interesting that this is the Intercepted edition, something like 28, and it's called American Psycho, and that's where we start.
My name is Donald Trump. I am 71 years old. I live in the White House in Mar-a-Lago in Bedminster and in Trump Tower in the penthouse. Paul Manafort has the 43rd floor. Guido Lombardi is on the 62nd and 63rd floors. I don't believe in taking care of myself because I don't need to. I mean, I just grab that pussy. I eat McDonald's, KFC, and have zero exercise routine. In the morning, if my face is a little puffy, I'll put on a frozen Trump steak while tweeting. I have 38 million followers now. That includes the sex bots, white supremacists, and a lot of Macedonians. Great people. They love Trump. After I remove the Trump steak, I use a half a container of Vaseline mixed with a little gasoline. In the shower, I use an Old Spice gel, Steel Courage. Then I apply a bright orange facial mask, which I leave on for 10 minutes while I prepare the rest of my routine. I always use a primer coat with little or no alcohol because alcohol dries your face out and makes you look like Carly Fiorina. Then the first coat of spray bronzer, then Melania's anti-aging eye balm, followed by a final coat of orange number 7. And don't forget the anti-baldness medication. That's what makes me nice and crazy. There is an idea of a Donald J. Trump, some kind of abstraction, but there is no real me, only a collection of emotional states assembled into the illusion of a human being. And though I can hide my cold gaze and you can shake my small hand and feel clammy flesh gripping you, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably not comparable, I simply am not there.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 28 of Intercepted.
If the righteous many do not confront the wicked few, then evil will triumph.
Donald Trump appeared before the United Nations General Assembly this week and read a speech written by his vile little political advisor, Stephen Miller. That speech was as belligerent as it was ridiculous. And as Trump read the speech, his chief of staff, General John Kelly, appeared visibly embarrassed. Or maybe he just had a ripping headache that forced him to constantly place his head in his hands. But for hawkish neocons, those that feared that Trump might not be heinous enough for them on some of their core issues, this speech must have felt like a grand relief, especially when Trump echoed George W. Bush's axis of evil, when he heaped praise on Israel, and came pretty close to calling for regime change in Venezuela and Iran. And I can just imagine Trump, when he was reading drafts of Stephen Miller's speech or the final version of it last night, and thinking how amazing he was going to sound when he delivered this zinger that really was about teaching socialism a lesson.
The problem in Venezuela is not that socialism has been poorly implemented, but that socialism has been faithfully implemented.
My favorite part of this exact moment was that several UN delegates were actually openly laughing at Trump when he delivered it. But then there was this insanity about North Korea.
We will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime. The United States is ready, willing, and able. But hopefully, this will not be necessary. That's what the United Nations is all about.
For Donald Trump to threaten to, quote, totally destroy a country of 25 million people, people who already live under a horrid dictatorship, that's a serious cry for intervention. It's an insane thing to do, but Trump did it. And calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man, well, first of all, it's not even a little bit funny. It was as dumb as Kid Rock. Well, just leave it there. It was as dumb as Kid Rock. But it's a form of dumb that is so unbelievably dangerous for the entire world. And of course, you know, Trump did his customary bragging, oh, the stock market's doing so amazing because of me, and America's finally getting on its way back to greatness, blah, blah, blah. In the speech, Trump also boasted that the U.S. was finally going to have a massive military budget. Finally. As though it's been relying on like GoFundMe or Kickstarter for all that war and drone bombing and occupying countries that the Kenyan socialist Obama was doing.
Last month, I announced a new strategy for victory in the fight against this evil in Afghanistan. From now on, our security interests will dictate the length and scope of military operations, not arbitrary benchmarks and timetables set up by politicians.
But what Trump was referring to is that the U.S. Senate overwhelmingly approved $80 billion in increased military spending, a $700 billion budget for the military. And this wasn't some super secret White House operation sponsored by Vladimir Putin and Julian Assange. No, this was done with the support of almost every single Democrat in the Senate. Only four Democrats voted against that funding bill, as did Bernie Sanders and three Republicans. This bill that the Democrats supported, it gave even more money to the military than Trump had asked for things like fighter aircraft and extra ships. Bring this up the next time you hear one of these Democratic leaders or their supporters poo-poo Bernie Sanders and his allies and their Medicare for All plan. Because, oh, how are we going to pay for it? They gave Trump more than he asked for. Or like when Hillary Clinton was chastising Bernie Sanders over his plan to offer free college. She said it was like Sanders asking America to buy a pony. Hello, Sanders' proposal for free public college tuition, that was estimated to cost $47 billion a year. But the Democrats just gave Trump $80 billion in increased funding, $700 billion total, for more wars and weapons and sweetheart deals with big defense corporations. That's real principle there. That's fighting for the little man. None of this buy America a pony shit. Let's get more cluster bombs and cruise missiles and boots on the ground. Yeah, let's give the insane lunatic in the White House more than he actually asked for. Hashtag resistance. To kick off the show today, we're going to take a deep dive look at one of the most powerful voices in Donald Trump's head when it comes to economic issues, and that is the voice of Goldman Sachs. Remember how Trump attacked Hillary Clinton for giving big money speeches at Goldman Sachs? I mean, it was a totally legitimate criticism of Hillary Clinton, and Wall Street loves the Clintons. But then Trump, once he becomes president, turns around and brings in more Goldman Sachs people to the administration than Bush or Obama ever had at a given time during their entire two-term presidencies. Among the Goldman Sachs mafia dons masquerading as public servants in the White House is Gary Cohn. Gary Cohn was the president of Goldman Sachs before Donald Trump named him as the head of the National Economic Council and Trump's top economic advisor. To discuss what some people call government Sachs, I'm joined now by Gary Rivlin. He's a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. He's also a former New York Times reporter. And along with Michael Hudson, Gary has a fascinating story up at The Intercept this week called Government by Goldman. Gary Cohn is giving Goldman Sachs everything it ever wanted from the Trump administration. Gary Rivlin, welcome to Intercepted.
It's great to be here.
Let's start with kind of, I think, what for most people is the obvious hypocrisy here, the sort of top level hypocrisy, which is that Trump railed against Hillary Clinton, characterizing her as the Goldman Sachs candidate when they were fighting each other for the presidency.
She got caught in a total lie. Her papers went out to all her friends at the banks, Goldman Sachs and everybody else. And she said things, WikiLeaks, that just came out. and she lied.
And yet, as you point out in your piece, Trump at its peak had six people who had worked for Goldman Sachs in his administration.
Right. Actually, technically five, because the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission was a lawyer for Goldman Sachs and married to someone who works at Goldman Sachs. So I don't know if we can include him as one of them. You know, it's interesting. You always hear this.
Let's give it a half. We'll say five and a half.
Five and a half. You know, I mean, it's interesting because you hear that, Goldman Sachs wins no matter who wins the White House. And there's a lot of truth to that. You go back and every administration has one, maybe two. George W. Bush at his peak had three Goldman Sachs veterans. So having the five and a half, if we've determined that that's what it is much more of a Goldman contingency. Elizabeth Warren had a very funny line that, you know, the White House is now a branch office of Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, they could have their own wing of the White House, especially with all these people leaving and getting fired. There definitely is the space in the White House for it. But why do you think it was that Hillary Clinton, that hit her and it stuck with her, that she was the candidate of Goldman Sachs?
It started with Ted Cruz, who was, in quotes, in bed with Goldman Sachs. His wife had worked for Goldman Sachs at the time. Or to me, Goldman Sachs for Donald Trump was just an easy shorthand. I think we all use that. Goldman Sachs is almost a stand-in for Wall Street and manipulating money and, you know, businesses that really don't do anything than help take apart other businesses.
It's a global power structure that is responsible for the economic decisions that have robbed our working class, stripped our country of its wealth, and put that money into the pockets of a handful of large corporations and political entities.
But, you know, for Hillary Clinton, I mean, you take $650,000, whatever the exact number was, for three speeches, that's going to stick to you. And you know, besides that, her policies were generally very friendly. Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO, and Gary Cohn, the president, were supporters of Hillary Clinton. Much of Wall Street supported Hillary Clinton. You know, we'll have our nice little social liberal policies. But, you know, when it comes to business, let's calm down this financial regulation stuff. Let's be a little bit more, in quotes, friendly to business.
I know the guys at Goldman Sachs. They have total control over him. Just like they have total control over Hillary Clinton. They have total. But they have no control. They have no control over Donald Trump. I don't want their money. I don't need their money.
I think it would be really helpful to explain what Goldman Sachs is and what it does.
So it's an investment bank. And traditionally what an investment bank does is arrange financing for corporations and governments. So the startup that goes public, an initial public offering, a company needs to raise money to build a new factory. A government needs money for a bridge or what have you. Interestingly, in the 1990s, I covered technology. I covered Silicon Valley. And Goldman Sachs, I always respected the Goldman Sachs guys back then, or people, because they're all smart and they had what they called long-term greed rather than what we see nowadays, which is short-term greed. When Gary Cohn and Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman, started there, that still was the main way they made money. But over the years, it's gotten much more into trading, into derivatives, into buying and selling currencies and interest rate swaps and these increasingly more complicated things, commodities, in large part because of the influence of Gary Cohn and Lloyd Blankfein. It turned from gentlemanly Goldman Sachs, which again, I had some respect for back then, into this rip your face off. We no longer have customers. We just are trying to make as much money as we can in a short-term greedy way.
Well, and part of that, as you write, was when Goldman itself went public, then this ethos of the client or the customer comes first was replaced by, we want to make a lot of money ourselves too. And the priority was sort of the institution itself and making a lot of money for the people that run it.
When Goldman Sachs, before they went public in 1999, they were a partnership. And so if the government fines you a few $100 million for misbehavior, for bending the laws, for breaking the laws, you as the partners had to pay that. Once it's a publicly traded company, you know, the company pays the fines and there's no personal consequence for the misbehavior.
Talk about Gary Cohn's role in the subprime mortgage catastrophe and Goldman's key role in it.
Cohn took over as president of Goldman Sachs, the number two spot, the president and chief operating officer in 2006. But most interesting to me were the 4 or 5 years leading up to 2006. He, by happenstance in the early 2000s, took over the mortgage trading desk, the desk that would do mortgage-backed securities, the, you know, these complex packagings of subprime loans, of loans of any kind, but what got all the attention where it grew phenomenally was subprime loans. And it was Gary Cohn himself who aggressively got Goldman Sachs into mortgage-backed securities. They were a minor player when he took over this role within Goldman Sachs. And he turned them into a major player, meaning they were doing $100 billion of these or more every single year. And Goldman Sachs, which had barely been a player, became one of the major players in the securitization at the same time. And this isn't Gary Cohn. This is the company more generally. They were providing the lines of credit to Ameriquest, one of the biggest subprime lenders, to New Century, another one of the biggies in subprime. So they were both providing the capital to allow what turns out to be some nefarious players to be making these loans. And then they were a big player in buying up these loans right after they made, putting them into big packages and selling them to pension funds, to wealthy people, to whoever wanted to buy a piece of these. It was quite the thing. And you were making money for a while until you weren't.
I mean, explain that. What is the product that they were essentially asking these pension funds or other, you know, quote unquote, investors to buy into when they were engaged in these subprime mortgages and the securities behind them?
So investment banks, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, all the major banks you've heard of that were involved in investment banking, they would buy up huge quantities of loans, largely subprime loans, from lenders. And they would package them together in a single mortgage-backed security and then sell off small slices. What Goldman Sachs wasn't sharing with their clients, what other banks were not sharing with their clients, is that what they were purporting were very safe investments, were not very safe investments. And we all saw the hard way. Once it fell apart, loans that they were selling were suddenly worth 80 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar. And so holding these packages, the underlying investment was worth less and less and less to the point where they were virtually worthless.
People were just defaulting left and right on the mortgages.
Right. The default rates were huge on subprime mortgages.
And also we should remind people that they basically eliminated almost any requirements for people to get a mortgage. But a big part of this was that they were taking advantage of poor people or people who had a desire to live beyond their means and shoving these mortgages at them and saying, you can afford this mansion.
And you know, here again, we're kind of the old-fashioned way of banking versus the newfangled way of banking. In the old days, a bank really cared if you can afford to pay it back because the bank held the mortgage for the 30 years that the terms were for. Once you started with securitization, which became much more popular in the 80s and the 90s, suddenly the lender didn't care. They're going to get rid of this in a month anyway. You know, let me make the loan. I'll make some quick money and let the next person down the line worry about whether the people are going to actually pay back the loan.
And Gary Cohn's specific role in the subprime mortgage catastrophe.
At the end of 2006, there's a meeting inside Goldman. Gary Cohn's not at it, but he's getting emails afterwards. And then from then on is following it very closely. There's a whole email trail. A Senate investigative committee looked into this. And so there's a trove of emails that you could just dip in and see Gary Cohn and others in Goldman Sachs. But they said that, we see this going south rather quickly, the subprime market. And that's where they came up with the Big Short. And that's saying that, hey, those companies that we've been providing lines of credit to, Ameriquest, New Century, let's short those stocks. Let's bet against those stocks. Let's find other ways of betting against the subprime market because we think it's going to go down. And if we put this bet down, we're going to make a lot of money because we're shorting the market. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what investment bankers do. They're smart about money. They figure out what the trend is. The part that I think is unforgivable is that they never shared this information with their own customers. In fact, they had a problem. They're buying up subprime loans all the time. They have billions and billions of dollars in subprime loans in their inventory. And so they have to get rid of them. December of 2006, they say, okay, the Big Short, we believe the market's going to go south. Through the first half of 2007, through the summer of 2007, they're still selling these mortgage-backed securities to their clients. There were emails that came out that they're in quotes products. Hey, great job, guys, making lemon out of lemonade. Where their job, as they describe it, is to provide information to their customers so they can make wise investments. They're offloading these securities because, of course, they don't want to own them. Who wants to own mortgage-backed securities? They themselves have decided that these things are not going to be worth nearly what we paid for them. And so they were secretly selling them the big short.
How much of that shitty deal did you sell to your clients after June 22, 2007?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that, but the price would have reflected levels that they wanted to invest in.
Oh, of course. But they don't know what's a... You didn't tell them you thought it was a shitty deal.
Well, I didn't say that.
No. Who did? Your people.
In fact, there's an email that was sent to Gary Cohn from his chief financial operating officer, CFO, calling it the big short. I mean, it's become this famous expression that most people know nowadays. It was actually famously used within an email to Gary Cohn while he was president of Goldman Sachs.
I want to buy swaps on mortgage bonds, a credit default swap that will pay off if the underlying bond fails.
You want to bet against the housing market?
Yes.
Why? Those bonds only fail if millions of Americans don't pay their mortgages. That's never happened in history. If you'll excuse me, Dr. Berry, it seems like a foolish investment. Well,
based on prevailing sentiment of the market, banks, and popular culture, yes, it's a foolish investment, but everyone's wrong.
As depicted in the movie with Steve Carell and Christian Bale, who I thought was fantastic in the Big Short film, is it literally true that sort of the way that Goldman Sachs and others found out about this was because of one kind of quirky character who really did see this coming, who went in and basically said, I want you guys to allow me to short subprime loans?
Yeah, I mean, it was more than one character if you talk about all the banks. But in the case of Goldman Sachs, the one character was this guy, John Paulson. He wasn't well known then.
He's, and not related to Hank Paulson.
Right. Hank Paulson, Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush, who had been the CEO of Goldman Sachs right before that. That was one of George W. Bush's three Goldman Sachs people. John Paulson is this unknown hedge fund guy or unknown to Goldman Sachs people. He comes in and is describing in early 2006, he wants to short the subprime market, and they're thinking he's a wackadoodle. Like, okay, sure, you want to do that? We'll arrange this. You're going to pay us fees for it? Okay. They did several of these for him, and they suddenly realized, like, hey, wait a second. He's on to something, and he goes from being a customer to a rival. And they start doing what John Paulson did. So, in fact, there was one guy who taught them or, you know, opened their eyes to, like, hey, this is not going to turn out very well.
Trump, you know, for all of his railing against Goldman Sachs in the context of Hillary Clinton, when he then starts appointing these Goldman people and then publicly has to sort of defend it, earlier this summer, you write, Trump boasted about his team of economic advisors at a rally in Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
This is the president of Goldman Sachs, smart. Having him represent us, he went from massive paydays to peanuts, to little tiny.
He actually does. He went from $20 million a year, and he has a very low salary, something like 30, 40 grand a year. So I guess he went from peanuts. There was a big advantage in him leaving. I don't know if people know this, but when you take a government job, there's this magic window where you can sell your stock and not pay capital gains because you have to do it to satisfy ethics regulations. So Gary Cohn at this point owns like $250 million of Goldman stock, and he was able to sell it without paying capital gains, which you could roughly estimate saved himself about $50 million. So in that quote, he talks about the great pains and the great sacrifice it's cost him all this money. Like, well, yeah, he's not making a salary anymore, but boy, that was a nice little moment for him.
But my favorite quote here that you guys point out of Trump's is this.
So somebody said, why did you appoint a rich person to be in charge of the economy? I said, no, it's true. I said, because that's the kind of thinking we want. I mean, you know, really, because they're representing the country. They don't want the money. They're representing.
Trump said he needed great, brilliant business minds so the world doesn't take advantage of us. You write, how else could he get the job done? Trump continues, I love all people, rich or poor, but in those particular positions, I just don't want a poor person. Does that make sense? Trump asked, and the crowd cheered.
You know, I mean, on the one hand, it's the one and only time that Donald Trump has explained how he used Goldman Sachs on the campaign trail as a cudgel, like, I'm going to beat you over the head if you have any ties to Goldman Sachs. And then he turns around and, you know, the Treasury Secretary is from Goldman Sachs. His chief political advisor for 7-8 months was from Goldman. I always wanted an explanation from that. I guess you could say that was an explanation. At least he acknowledged that there was this contradiction here. But I mean, isn't that the Trump administration? I'm going to fight for you, little guy. And if you look at what Gary Cohn is doing as Trump's chief economic advisor, it's a pretty radical agenda. It's not radical in the sense of Steve Bannon radical, but he wants to cut corporate taxes by 57%, from 35% corporate tax to 15%. So I went back and I figured out what kind of advantage would that be for Goldman Sachs. They'd save $1.5 to $2 billion a year. Goldman Sachs is more than any other firm on Wall Street is big in what's called prop trading. That means using their own money to buy shopping centers and hotels and invest their own money. Under Dodd-Frank, the financial reform bill in 2010, they greatly limited prop trading. And about half of Goldman Sachs's business to now, even though there's a law against it, you know, is prop trading. And of course, he wants to do in Gary Cohn, you know, all of Dodd-Frank, which include prop trading. That's worth billions and billions of dollars every single year to Goldman Sachs. You know, they talk about a different approach to infrastructure, the $1 trillion infrastructure plan. It's kind of left, right, middle. Everyone understands that we need to be dealing with our infrastructure problem in this country. But the Goldman Sachs plan, the plan that Gary Cohn gave President-elect Donald Trump when he was just Goldman Sachs's president meeting with Donald Trump before he was named to the White House, he said, you know, why don't we put up a little bit of money, in this case, a couple hundred billion dollars of government money, and the rest will be private financing from Wall Street firms. And guess what? Firm is among the three or four largest in the public infrastructure business, Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs is huge in IPOs. When Gary Cohn was president of Goldman Sachs, he was lobbying to loosen the initial public offering laws. Well, 6 months into the administration, the SEC has loosened the IPO rules, which is worth hundreds of millions of dollars to Goldman Sachs alone. And so here was the president who said, I'm going to represent you, little guy, because it's the big firms like Goldman Sachs that are draining the economy, that are enriching themselves at your expense. And in the position as to head his economic policy team is a guy who, down the line, you look at every policy, is trying to perpetuate the Goldman Sachs of the world, the Wall Street firms, draining the economy at the expense of the little guy.
Trump is...
Yeah, talking about that SOB Colin Kaepernick in Alabama, where he's picked a senatorial candidate in that melee down there. Okay, I want to get to the next segment from The Intercepted, but I do want to reiterate that there's this anti-war teach-in from 1 to 5. I didn't mention the student group that's involved, Students for Economic Empowerment. And they're going to kick it off. Francis Boyle at 110 nominally, C.G. Esterbrook, and Rich Whitney in the first segment, Q&A. They've got a few minutes for that. Libya and Syria, Israel and Palestine, Dave Green talking from Jewish Voice for Peace affiliation. Harry Michelady, who's with STEM Students Rage Against the War Machine, he's going to sing that song probably. Costs of War, Martin Brussel, maybe his advisor. I didn't mention Father Tom Royer speaking about El Salvador. Dave Johnson, Venezuela and Central America. A lot on Honduras, no doubt. That's 1 to 5, and Stuart Levy is documenting that. But you can pop in or pop out if you like. Coincidentally, at the mosque, which is kind of in the hood, on Lincoln, at 2 to 4, there's the 4th Annual Immigrant Welcome Awards. And a fair number of people are interested, according to my Facebook feed, but you can expect food and fun for the whole family. It says this is a CU Immigration Forum participating with Muslim American Society Society Center of Urbana-Champaign and the cities of Urbana and Champaign. cuimmigrationforum.org for more info. And you can find all of The Intercepted. It's easy to find as a podcast. Mark Badawi's got Gareth Porter, my man. He's a U of I grad, talking about sarin in Syria. Who did it benefit and who did it? Cy Hirsch has written about it, but he doesn't get it in The New Yorker anymore. Anyway, I'm talking over time here because I want to get all of it, and I'm not. This is another segment from The Intercepted, and it's about policing, and it's about Israel training police. So I've already over-talked here. Might run over a little bit. Alice Spurley.
In direct response about the 1033 to the program. Images of these militarized police confronting protesters. Well, Attorney General Jeff Sessions made the announcement on behalf of Trump that they would be getting rid of Obama's restrictions. And Sessions made that announcement in a speech in front of the Fraternal Order of Police, the largest police union in the country.
President Trump this day is issuing an executive order that will make it easier to protect yourselves and your communities. He is rescinding restrictions from the prior administration that limited your agency's ability to get equipment through federal programs, including life-saving gear.
To discuss all of this, I'm joined by my colleague at The Intercept, Alice Sperry. Her most recent piece, which we're also going to discuss, is called Israel Security Forces Are Training American Cops Despite History of Rights Abuses. Alice, welcome back to Intercepted.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with the very big picture here. Explain the roots of the 1033 program and what it is.
The 1033 program has actually been around for many years. It was signed into law by President Clinton in the 90s. But it's really been talked about more recently, and specifically in the aftermath of the Ferguson protests. And basically, this is a Pentagon program by which police departments across the country can buy excess supplies from the military, including, you know, like grenade launchers and armored vehicles. And we really saw a lot of that equipment in Ferguson and in following protests against police brutality from 2014 onwards. And so in 2015, President Obama actually signed restrictions into place so that not all police departments would be able to get as much material. That was really one of the programs that was key to the militarization of police departments. And of course, President Trump is, you know, in his effort to undo many of the efforts of police reform. Really, President Obama hasn't done a whole lot of police reform, but there were programs put in place that Trump has very promptly rescinded, and the 1033 is one of them.
You know, we've seen how militarized gear can sometimes give people a feeling like there's an occupying force as opposed to a force that's part of the community that's protecting them and serving them. Can alienate and intimidate local residents and send the wrong message. So we're going to prohibit some equipment made for the battlefield that is not appropriate for local police departments.
How widespread is the transfer of this kind of equipment to state or local law enforcement agencies?
And it was pretty massive. You've seen departments across the country, not just in big cities, but really everywhere. And you'll see like these SWAT teams coming in, you know, with full body armor and full military equipment in small towns on drug raids. And some of that has been exposed in recent years. There's also been a few incidents in which, you know, like full SWAT teams would like break into somebody's home looking for a presumed drug dealer and just finding kids or grandmothers and, you know, shooting up the place. And so like there has been some attention brought to these programs. It's really, they've really made it across the country to all police departments.
Police department, search warrant! Police department, search warrant!
It's really interesting to see how, particularly in the post 9/11 world, the United States has all of their new toys and weapons of war. And we've seen this increased use of technologies that were developed by the CIA or the Defense Department used for surveillance of people that were determined to be terrorists or terror suspects, like stingrays and other surveillance gear that's being used to go after so-called common criminals. And this is a pretty ominous development because of the U.S. role in the world, because of the leading edge of technology that the U.S. finds itself at with the weapons of war and surveillance. And now it's being used in everyday drug busts, but also increasingly to face down against nonviolent protesters.
Yes, absolutely. That's actually where we've seen most of this. And this is how a lot of the attention was brought to these programs. You know, in Ferguson, we saw armored vehicles coming through the suburbs of St. Louis. And since then, we've seen that scene repeated in Baltimore and Chicago and other cities across the country, not always big cities. Of course, during the conventions, there's always a big fear that, you know, police will show up as they have in the past with full of military gear. And for instance, I covered the Republican convention in Cleveland, where there really ultimately weren't that many protesters, but the city was on lockdown and police were armed as if they were going to war. So that's very much the image they're putting out there.
I remember when I was starting off in journalism, I was in Seattle in 1999 for the World Trade Organization meetings where there was this huge uprising. And there, I think, was the first time that a new generation of activists faced down against this. It's not even paramilitarization, really. It's the militarization of the police. And so what Trump is doing right now is basically saying, okay, they put a little bit too short of a leash on this program. Let's just take the leash off completely.
Mm-hmm. And it's very important to note this, that, you know, the militarization of police is not a partisan issue in any way. It's not that Democrats really ever opposed it. And that's why when I talk about President Obama's reforms on policing, I always say those are very limited, very belated reforms that he was able to pass. They really just kind of began to tackle the issue, but they weren't nearly sufficient. And, you know, Trump rescinding many of them is predictable, but...
But see, if you get a job at one of these like venture capital firms or hedge funds that Obama's getting paid $500,000 to speak at, maybe you could ask him a question about that.
I'll try.
let's turn to this really fascinating story that you published at The Intercept. I think for a lot of people in this country, they would have no idea what you're talking about. Israeli security forces training American cops. What does Israel have to do with local policing in the United States?
Well, Israelis are actually training local police and private security forces all over the world. That's really one of their big businesses. But what's so fascinating to me about this story is that it's been on my radar at least for a decade, if not more. It's something that's not a secret by any means. I mean, these trips are advertised on the websites of the groups that sponsor them, and yet it is never talked about. It's really fascinating to me that even now that we have so much attention on police departments in the U.S., on the militarization of police, the fact that these officers, and we're talking about hundreds of them, are going to Israel yearly to train with military forces there is just not talked about. And I think that's quite fascinating.
I mean, I first encountered Israeli private security in 2005 when I was in New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. There was a firm called Instinctive Shooting International, ISI, that was hired to guard a wealthy white enclave in New Orleans. And when I was researching at the time, I was sort of stunned to see how deeply embedded Israeli firms are in every level of the U.S. Homeland Security apparatus in terms of training, and also the national security apparatus. That, to me, I think is one of the most disturbing aspects of this, that Israel is viewed in the world as one of the most efficient assassins that exists on the international scene. And now they're increasingly working with American police forces armed with what are clearly weapons of war, not policing.
Right. You think American cops don't need any further militarizing, but I guess you can always get better at killing, I suppose. But no, I actually met Israeli security forces in Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake there in 2010. So they're everywhere. This is like a huge business for Israel. It makes sense, right? When your entire country has gone through the military and everybody has military experience, that's, you know, a great thing to have in your resume if you're going to look to make money, that's something you can market. And what's really interesting is they've been able to market their experience in the occupied territories, and their occupation of Palestine has become this selling point, really, that's put on brochures that sort of highlight Israel's strength as a counterterrorism force. But when they train American cops on counterterrorism, a majority of what they're teaching them ends up being used against civilians in the U.S. I mean, most police departments in the U.S. do not face serious terrorism threats.
This is an incredible part of your story. I just want to share this with our listeners. You write, in the aftermath of 9/11, Israel seized on its decades-long experience as an occupying force to brand itself a world leader in counterterrorism. U.S. law enforcement agencies took the Jewish state up on its expertise by participating in exchange programs sponsored by an array of pro-Israel groups like the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, and the Anti-Defamation League. What on earth are those lobbying entities doing arranging counterterrorism, so-called counterterrorism training for U.S. police forces?
I mean, and I think perhaps the most ironic of them is the Anti-Defamation League, which really presents itself as a civil rights organization that here in the U.S. counters supposedly abusive policing. And they, in the aftermath of Ferguson, have been very strongly opposed to people that draw comparisons between the occupation of Palestine and the militarization of police in the U.S. You know, a lot of people in Ferguson were sort of comparing themselves to Gaza, which is questionable in many ways, obviously. But there is definitely a solidarity that's being built between occupied people in different ways.
Right. And you talk about in recent days, there was this delegation of top U.S. law enforcement officers in Israel for a seminar that was sponsored by the Anti-Defamation League. It was a national counterterrorism seminar. Topics such as leadership in a time of terror, balancing the fight against crime and terrorism. More than 200 law enforcement executives from over 100 departments in the U.S. participated in this?
Have been participating in this since 2004 when it first launched. This week, there were several top U.S. officials. Sometimes immigration enforcement agents also participate. Sometimes campus police participate in these trainings. They go to Israel and they learn from Israeli police as well as the IDF, so the Defense Forces military, as well as security forces that really work on border patrol. And I think the most important thing to remember here is that these are U.S. cops that are tasked with enforcing civil law and criminal law here in the U.S., but they're learning from people that are enforcing military rule over occupied people. So the parallel is really quite interesting. I mean, Israeli security forces operate in a non-democratic context, and these are U.S. public servants that are learning those tactics, presumably to bring back and use against U.S. citizens.
You specifically talk in your article about the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Commander, Morgan Kane, who attended the training. What did the D.C. police say to you when you reached out to them?
Right. So, well, first of all, we only know about Morgan Kane, who's a female commander, actually, in D.C. And we only know about this because Jewish Voice for Peace, which is one of the organizations that's been exposing the strips, was able to find her name in a document they FOIA'd. And so I reached out to the police department in D.C. And basically, they, as many others, really framed the strip as a counterterrorism opportunity. It's an opportunity for D.C. police to learn, you know, techniques that will keep D.C. residents and tourists safe. That's really what they present. Never mind that D.C. also has major problems, as many other cities do, with policing its own poor black, brown citizens. It has a history of, you know, abuses. There have been a number of police killings there, as there have been in other cities. And so it's really difficult to kind of draw a line and say, I'm learning about counterterrorism and I'll come back and not use it against everybody else and still police in a constitutional manner. I mean, these things really are connected. You can't separate one from the other. There's kind of this idea that counterterrorism is okay, but non-constitutional policing isn't. And even on the counterterrorism front, I mean, there's plenty, obviously, of abuse that comes out of these trips. For instance, the NYPD infamous Muslim spying program a few years back, that was pretty much modeled on the surveillance of Palestinians in the West Bank. And one of the officers, one of the top commanders actually in the NYPD that was behind it, had participated in one of these trainings in Israel. So you really see these techniques and how these methods are brought back home and put in place against U.S. citizens, in this case, Muslim citizens. But one other thing I would point out is that the exchange also goes both ways. I mean, you'd think Israelis don't have anything to learn from Americans in terms of oppressing populations, but they do. And one thing that, for instance, happened last year in Israel is that the government passed basically the equivalent of our stop and frisk law, which, of course, has been very much contested in a number of U.S. cities. Meanwhile, in Israel, this new law is essentially doing the same thing. And of course, because the law itself is so vague, where basically any officers can stop anyone they suspect of being up to something, essentially, that's been applied very discriminately. And it's, you know, with racism towards Palestinians.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of cohesion between how the U.S. Conducts itself in the world and how Israel conducts itself in Palestine. And increasingly, we're seeing those two merge in the U.S. But I wanted to get your analysis on, once again, the violence that we saw of the police in St. Louis in recent days.
I mean, I always feel like St. Louis is just a little bit ahead of the rest of the country in terms of finding out the flashpoints and really sort of showing you in a nutshell what policing and the relationship between police and black and brown communities in this country is. As you know, I was in Ferguson 3 years ago. I'm kind of beginning to see the same thing happening again. I don't know if you saw from people that were on the scene, there was a moment when after making a number of arrests, police reportedly started chanting,
Whose streets are streets?
Which is, of course, the protester anthem by default. And the fact that police would have really did the arrogance and the nerve to chant this in the streets that they are supposed to serve is just astounding to me. So really St. Louis, I think, captures this kind of conflict. St. Louis has